Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, June 15th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk with Eric Scholl about a new business in town, Glay Scholl Grinds. We'll find out about upcoming fish and game outdoor skills classes. We'll talk to Jody Weber about this Friday's performance by the Weber Dance Troupe. And Mike McLaren will be here to highlight Canvas Improv classes for youth. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon. Currently 79 degrees at the Juno Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The leader of Canada's Assembly of First Nations is critical of the government's response to the recent report on Indian residential schools. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded that what happened to Native children from the mid-1800s to the late 1900s was cultural genocide. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
The commission made 94 recommendations, including better education for all Canadians about the residential school era, an apology from the Pope, and other measures aimed at reconciliation to restart the relationship between Natives and non-Natives. 150,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children were forced to attend the schools, which were funded by the government and run by churches. Thousands were physically, sexually, or emotionally abused. About 6,000 died. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Perry Bellegarde, is urging action from the government of Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper quickly. He says there's no point in producing a report if no one acts on it.
It's an election year. October 19th, there's a federal election. We look at the responses we've had to date. You know, the Liberals, Justin Trudeau has said, yes, we're going to implement the recommendations. The NDP, Thomas Mulcair, said, yes, we're going to implement the recommendations. Where is our yes from this Conservative government for First Nations people? Everybody else seems to be getting a yes from the Conservatives. Like, there's tax credit for families, the businesses are getting tax cuts. Where is the yes from the Conservative Party for First Nations people?
Bellegarde says he still hopes the federal government will act, but if it doesn't, he says First Nations would mobilize for a federal election coming this fall, and that means getting Native people out to vote. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
On Sunday, the Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission released findings of its two-year examination of Indian child welfare in Maine. The report shows disproportionate rates of Native children entering foster care compared to non-Native children. The report includes a number of recommendations, such as respecting tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction. Nearly 300 people were on hand to hear findings of the report at a ceremony in Herman. It's been a year since the family of a Lakota woman learned that the star athlete and musician had been killed during a high-speed pursuit by tribal police in South Dakota. As Jim Kent reports, Feather Ray Colomb's memorial was held over the weekend, but her family still has questions about what led to her death.
When word spread across the Rosebud Sioux Reservation that Feather Ray Colomb had been killed during a high-speed pursuit in May 2014, her friends and family were shocked. The 20-year-old Lakota woman had no traffic violations and had never been in trouble with the law. She'd been a star high school athlete. Feather Ray had also gained some renown after taking part in the award-winning student documentary More Than That, a Lakota response to critical media observations of life on South Dakota reservations. 1 year later, Jackie Colomb still wants answers to why Feather Ray was being chased, why she wasn't allowed to see her granddaughter's remains before they were sent for an autopsy, and why she still hasn't received Feather Ray's cell phone.
There was like 12 classified documents that they didn't send. We didn't have any video cams. We didn't get her pictures out of her camera. And then they didn't have the autopsy.
Jackie Colomb also questions why tribal police continued the chase that killed Feather Ray, since they admitted they knew who she was. Rosebud Sioux Tribal Police did not return calls, but FBI spokesperson Kyle Loven had this to say.
The investigation has been concluded by the FBI, and there'll be no prosecution forthcoming with respect to this investigation.
Meanwhile, the Colomb family has hired an attorney to investigate the death of Feather Ray Colomb. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Supported by the National Indian Education Association, an inclusive Native organization representing Native students, educators, families, communities, and tribes. Membership registration available at niea.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, June 15th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host on this beautiful Juno Afternoon. With me in the studio now is Eric Scholl. He's the owner of a shave ice cart called Glacial Grinds. Did I get that right, Eric?
Yes, Glacial Grinds.
Downtown.
Correct, downtown.
And I bet you are really busy today.
I am. This heat has brought out, brought out the people, definitely. People have spoken, and they are wanting some shave ice, and they're out there, and I have a couple employees out there handling it right now as best they can, sweating pretty bad out there, working pretty hard for me, so it's going pretty good right now.
Tell us where your cart is again.
So we are located 2nd and Main, across the street from Silverbow, kind of by the chalkboard over there.
Okay. And what is shave ice exactly?
Oh, right. Shave ice, I believe it originated in Hawaii. It's when I tell them it's shave ice, people get this concept that it's a snow cone, and it's nothing even close to a snow cone. Snow cones, they're really big chunks of ice. You're chomping at it. It's pretty much ice cubes. This is fine shaved ice, which is like, it's like snow. It's very soft. It's very fine. The flavors actually get absorbed into the ice versus having like a snow cone. It just goes straight to the bottom, and you're pretty much drinking a drink at the end of it. But then also we have our little own twist to it. We put ice cream on the bottom, which is great because once you get to the bottom of it, you have all these flavors that are mixed with this ice cream, and it's like an explosion in your mouth. It's just amazing. It's a great combination. And then we do have toppings like sweet cream. We have this specialty topping called hapia, which is a Hawaiian thing also, which my girlfriend Tiana, she creates. It's like a coconut milk cream base. We put that on top. You put it on top, it kind of freezes over instantly, and you eat it with the shaved ice, and it's delicious. It's amazing.
Sounds good. What are some of the other flavors you have?
We have about 25 different flavors. Popular ones, pina colada, we got strawberry, lime, mango, pineapple, banana, lime. I just say lime. We have a ton of flavors. We mix and match. We create our own. We are in the process of actually getting more flavors because we have people coming up. Do you have this? Do you have that? I'm like, no, it's my second day, but I'll get it for you. I'll write it down. I'll get the sugar-free ones for you. I've had a lot of demand for sugar-free also, and so it's day three in our operation, and we're working out the kinks just like any regular business would. We're open to the public's suggestions and comments, and I've been really trying to push the Facebook thing and getting reviews and things of that sort. But yeah, it's going really good. And we're really excited about the idea. Basically, we went down to Hawaii. This is the story of how it happened. So I was in Hawaii, and my girlfriend, she at the time raved about this place called JoJo's Shave Ice. And it's very popular, famous. So we went there. We were eating it. It just clicked in me. I just start thinking we should do this in Alaska. And then I like looked over to her and like half jokingly and yelling with glacier ice and kind of just half jokingly. And then she's like, started laughing. I'm like, no, seriously, let's try to do this, And then I worked, I was working at the state at the time, super busy, had two jobs working at Salt also. The state job didn't work out. So I had a lot of free time at that point. And I decided, why not do it? The risk over the reward wasn't that bad. So I had a little small investment, and the reward is, it's paying off big time right now, and we're really excited about it, and you know, we're working with a bunch of people around town trying to get this established more, and it's going really good, and we have a really good support, and it's very exciting.
You said part of your background is in bartending. I thought that was interesting how you said that sort of has inspired some of the flavors you're doing. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So as a bartender, you try to create drinks that will go together. You know, obviously you don't want to put, like, you know, orange and, you know, some odd flavor, jalapeno, or, you know what I mean, lime and some crazy, you know, flavors together. So that taught me how to kind of create and fabricate these drinks. And also, I used to work at this place in St. Thomas, and it was called Duffy's Love Shack, and they're really well known for doing, like, over-the-top crazy exotic drinks with, like, all these weird toys and garnishes, right? And so I got a lot of experience from that. And so what we're doing for our specialty cones, we have about 7 of them. Each one comes with their own unique flair. I have one called the Mount McKinley. It's got, like, coconut shavings on top to act like snow. And then I put a little flag on top, Alaskan flag on top. I have my favorite one that I just love, and I tell everybody, and they start laughing immediately. It's called the Root Beer Float Plain. So it's root beer float flavored, and then honestly, we put a little toy float plane on top of it also, and we put, like, blue cream on top to make it look like the lake, and so we have, like, a little plane on top of the lake, and people love it, and the kids love it, and they're like, we don't advertise it on the menu, because we like to, like, give a surprise, like, you know, like, this is what you're paying for, this is why, you know, the cost is a little up there, and so it brings a lot of smiles to people's faces, and a lot of laughter and joking, and it's very fun, and that's the other thing I want to do. I want to create something that's fun, like a cool environment. Like, it's cool to hang out on the sidewalk and hang out and drink and eat some shave ice, and that's kind of the environment that's kind of going right now, and it's going real good.
All right. What are your hours?
It's going to be right now 12 to 7, but now, you know, yesterday we were doing so good, we stayed open till like 10, and so, you know, it's all going to vary. Our location hopefully will change. We'll get a better location, maybe go inside. We're looking to maybe get a spot for the winter, because eventually we want to be doing Hawaiian food also. So we actually have some spam musubi actually made out there right now. It might have sold out. It was going pretty quick. So we're doing that and some Hawaiian shave ice, and it's really good, and it's going great.
And you were saying you haven't quite gotten to glacier ice, but that's the plan, right?
Yes. I've been working with a friend, and, you know, we got to work out the logistics and, you know, how to get it and harvest it. And that was a process in itself, too, because I wanted to go to the Minhal Glacier to get ice. But I had to do a whole proposal to the feds, because the feds own it. And, you know, they shot me down, and I was kind of bummed about it. Then I had another idea through a friend, and you know, he's on board, but we just got to kind of talk about it first and, you know, really, you know, get the plan knocked out. And so it's been a long kind of up and down roller coaster of getting this started. I lost a couple spots, prime spots downtown in the beginning of the season, and it really kind of bummed me out. It deterred me from even doing it. And then I was like, you know what, I'll just take this spot. It might not be the best spot, but I have a good local following. And so, you know, they all were very responsive. The ones I talked to before I even opened it, they were all very responsive and, you know, really excited about it. So just having that, I felt like it would be a good little business venture. And it's been paying off. It's been really good.
All right. So 12 to 7 right now, how many days a week?
Every day, unless it's really, really, really nasty, which could happen.
Well, it sounds delicious.
Yes.
And I'll let you go, because I bet people are lining up.
Yeah,
right now.
I got to get back.
Eric Scholl, thank you so much. He owns Glacial Grinds downtown, across the street from the Chalkboard, there by the parking garage. Anything else you want to add, Eric?
No. If you stop by and you take a picture of our shaved ice, put it on Facebook, we will give you a free shaved ice the next visit. And locals do get a 15% discount, so take advantage of that.
And just out of curiosity, what's the price range for?
It's anywhere from $2 to $7. So it depends on what you're getting. If you get more ice cream, or you get ice cream toppings, you know, you could create it to make it, you know, a good price. If you get the specialty, it's a little bit more, because you're getting the toys and extra features. So.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
The 4th of July is always a fun time in Juneau, but this year will be extra special with the arrival of the new old-time Chautauqua. Made up of 55 talented artists, musicians, and vaudeville performers, including the Flying Karamazov Brothers, the new old-time Chautauqua will infuse the festivities with several opportunities for fun, including a community potluck, a chalk drawing contest, an afternoon of workshops, and of course their vaudeville show on the 3rd. The full event schedule and vaudeville show tickets are at k2.org.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, June 15th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 20 minutes after the hour. And joining me now in the studio, she is a wildlife education and outreach specialist, Tenny Benz of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Welcome to the show, Tenny.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, upcoming outdoor skills classes on Saturdays. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so we have the Alaskans Afield Outdoor Skills Program that's getting ready to start on June 27th. We did the series last summer, and it was a big success, and so we decided to offer some of the classes again this year. So on June 27th, we're offering outdoor survival, where you get to make a survival kit, head out, make shelters, build fires, learn how to keep safe if you get lost, and how to, you know, just kind of get out there and enjoy it without having to worry about, you know, having to survive and what to do if you get lost.
Okay, so that's the first one. How many are you going to do?
We are doing a series of 5 this summer. And so we've got Finding Your Way in the Woods coming up with map and compass and GPS. We have an All Things Wild on the Wetlands with emphasis on wild edibles and wild animals you might find out there. Fly Fishing Fundamentals is coming up in August. We have some great guys that are going to teach fly fishing on Montana Creek, so that'll be really fun. And then a riflery principles and practice. So we'll get people out to the Juneau indoor range out in the valley and get them shooting 22s with, you know, so they become more comfortable outdoors and using rifles out there.
Okay. What age range?
Most of the classes are open to families. So we have anybody, you know, usually our minimum age is about 5 or 6 for some of the classes, all the way up through adults. So we encourage families to come, and we have the cost for most of the classes is $20, but youth under 18 are free with each paying adult. So we really like to see families out there. There is a minimum age of 10 for the riflery class, though, just because it's a little bit safer if we have some older kids out there. So,
okay. Where should somebody go to find more information?
So people who are interested, we have a registration form and more information on the Fish and Game website, and that can be found at www.alaskansafield.adfg.alaska.gov. So if you go to the Fish and Game website and you can go click on the calendar, you can find a list of different classes that are offered and navigate in through there as well.
You have a limit, class limit?
We do. We actually have a minimum and a maximum. So we like to keep our classes fairly small, but we do need at least 10 people per class. So actually the survival class, if we don't have 10 signed up by this coming Friday, we may end up actually canceling that. So we're a little low on our numbers for that class this year. So we're hoping we get 10 by Friday, and then the class will be a go. And then the other classes range anywhere from about 10 to 15 people.
And how about instructors? Are you one?
I am. I'm doing the Finding Your Way in the Woods. And so I'll be doing some map and compass, the GPS, and some geocaching with the group. And Riley Woodford's teaching the outdoor survival. So those of you who know Riley from his musical performances and being on stage, you know how much fun he is, and he'll do a great job. He taught the survival class last year. It was really fun. So
okay.
Yeah.
Tenny, tell us one more time where to go for more information.
It's www.alaskansafield.adfg.alaska.gov.
Okay. Yeah. And the classes are generally from 10 to 1?
From 10 to 1 on Saturdays. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tenny Benz, thank you for your time. Anything else you want to add?
We hope to see you out there. It's a great chance to be outdoors.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Your dog barks, it don't mean nothing. Your dog barks, it don't mean nothing. My dog barks, it done treat something. Off running, he raised up his tail, he took off running. Come on, boys, let's go to hunting. Now the gun says boom, the coon says zip, the gun says boom, and the coon says zip. Oh, Red grabbed him with all his grip.
Me, Sue B, your on-air personality. I DJ Cross Currents every other Friday morning on KRNN 102.7. I like listening to KRNN because there's music for every mood, and it usually matches my mood, whether it's a local program or music that's brought in from other places. Tune in to KRNN 102.7. Make it a habit, music for your moods.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, June 15th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. And joining me now in the studio is Jody Weber of the Weber Dance Company from Boston. Welcome to the show, Jody.
Good afternoon. Thank you
for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in out of this beautiful afternoon.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, so let's see, a couple events coming up, a documentary film tonight, and then a big performance on Friday. Tell us about them.
Yeah, it's a really exciting week. So this evening, there's a free movie screening of Sacred Time, Sacred Space. It's a documentary created by Chris Engels that features our dance company, but quite a bit of the film footage was done here in Juneau about 2 years ago when Chris joined us. So you will be seeing some of the students of Juneau Dance Theater, as well as our company, as well as gorgeous footage from around Juneau as part of the documentary. And that's happening at 8 o'clock tonight at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. As I mentioned, it's free and open to the public, so come on out.
And tell us about your connection with Juneau.
Sure. So about 2007, I had a wonderful, wonderful dancer in my company by the name of Becca Roselle. And Becca grew up here in Juneau. And she helped me make a first connection to this community. And actually, this is the very, very first year that she hasn't joined us. We were missing her quite a bit, but she has a baby on the way momentarily. So she's not with us this year, but she still has family in the area. And that's how we got connected.
Okay. And for our listeners, tell us a little bit about the Weber Dance Company and the kind of productions that you do.
Sure. So we're a Boston-based company, and most of my work as an artist has been based in the environment and our relationship to the environment, and asking questions about that relationship as it exists, how we might create a healthier one. And I've done that across the works since about 2004. That's been my focus. So my work includes sections of dance that's pure dance, that's purely visual, with gorgeous, gorgeous music, and also includes sections of language. So in the case of our piece that we're sharing this week of Looms and Lilies, the language comes from three sources. Some of it comes from Thoreau, from his writings during his time at Walden Pond. Some of it comes from the Lowell Mill Girls, who were some of the first workers in industrialization that had to do with fabrics and creating fabrics. And those women talking about their lives, and there were also some wonderful writers during that time who were working in the mills writing poetry, really beautiful stuff. And then there's a third thread of language that was written by author Elaine Demopoulos, and she creates a contemporary character that is in conversation with these two historic characters, a Lowell Mill girl and also with Thoreau's writing. So,
okay. And this production is called Looms and Lilies.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So the lilies tie into Thoreau, like you were saying, right?
Yeah, so the tie-in with the title is that I was interested in some research that came out of Boston University. And what happened was when Thoreau was doing his experiment and living at Walden Pond, which is very near to my house and a place many of us who live in the Boston area go to find peace and take a walk in the woods, when he was living there, he recorded very, very carefully the bloom times of all the plants, all the native plants in the woods. And so a contemporary scientist took that information and did a comparative study today, and found that the average bloom time has shifted 3 weeks earlier. And so it's a real indication of how climate change is affecting our region. And so I thought that this was a really powerful and interesting way to start an artistic work. This person who's trying to live this experimental lifestyle, at the moment, industrialization is sort of blooming. And this contemporary person who's trying to say, look what's changed for us. And so since my company is all women, all female performers, I wanted to find also the female voice. So I looked at the Industrial Revolution as it existed in Lowell, Massachusetts, with as I said, the production of fabrics, the mass production of clothing. And these were women who probably had, you know, their work clothes and their Sunday clothes. So this was all new. And thinking about how they couldn't have imagined the kind of closets full of things that we have today and materialism and how that's expanded. And, of course, that is directly impacting climate change today.
Okay. Thinking of Friday night's performance at Thunder Mountain High School, what can the audience expect? Paint a picture for us. What does one of your performances look and sound like?
Sure. So I think that even if you're new to dance and you've never seen dance before, one of the great things about the way this production unfolds is that the language will really offer you a way to connect and enter into the piece. We also have five gorgeous, gorgeous performers in this company. And so just getting to see them move and see the sections of pure dance in itself is beautiful. But I think that the language is really helpful for people who are new to dance. There's also, with my work, because I'm very interested in helping the audience to have a positive experience, a good experience, we have a video introduction, which really talks about the roots of the work and identifies its theme before the actual live performance begins.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your background. So you have these sort of underlying environmental themes.
Yes.
You're a dancer as well. How did you figure out how to communicate about the environment through dance, and how did that all come together?
Right. So I'm also a professor of dance at a university in my my area, and I teach choreography, and so the language of dance is expressive for all of us. We all have bodies. We all move. It's a language that we all are using every day. So I've always, always been interested in that, and I think that my environmental, focus on environmental issues really came up before I ever came to Juno, but on my first trip to Alaska, which was in 2004. And I had the opportunity to sit and talk with a paleoclimatologist who was doing work there. And I was very moved by what he was saying and what his research was saying. And I just felt as an artist that it was important to find other ways to open the door to this kind of discussion. And so my language is dance. So mm-hmm. I use the language of dance to do that.
Sure. And you were saying sometimes you also work with writers as well to add some of the dialogue. You do some of the writing. Tell us more about that.
I do occasionally do a little bit of the writing. I did the introductory writing for this piece. The creative writing I left to a professional author, Elaine Demopoulos. But I'm also a writer in the historic vein. So I have a book out on dance that that talks about the history of my art form and connects it to the contemporary world. So I'm a little bit more an academic in the writing. So I let the creative part to the creative writers.
Okay. So again, that documentary is tonight, and that's about the Weber Dance Company.
It's about the Weber Dance Company, a little bit about the history of the art form and really connecting to these environmental
concerns. That's free
concerns.
At the Goldtown Nick, right?
That is free.
And then your performance at Thunder Mountain High School is this Friday at 7, is that right?
That's correct. And we've been working for the past 2 weeks. This is our third week at the Juno Dance Theater. And so joining us, we'll have a few pieces by the students from that organization. And we're just thrilled that they have invited us back this year.
Sounds like fun. Where should somebody get tickets?
Tickets are available at Hearthside Books and at the JACC and online at www.jahc.org. You can also visit junodance.org for more information and ticket sales.
All right, Jody Weber, it sounds great. Looms and Lilies this Friday night, a documentary tonight at the Goldtown Nick. Anything else you want to add? Anything we're missing?
Just that we've really enjoyed this community. It's such a wonderful group of people. We're happy to be back, and we hope to meet lots of you at the events this week.
Great. Jody Weber, thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 15th of June, 2015. It's the birthday of advertising exec-turned-writer Eileen Beckerman, born in Manhattan, 1935, who did not begin her writing career until the age of 60, and even then became a published author almost by accident. She had written and illustrated a book for her five children, Something to Remember Her By. She said, "My purpose was to say things to my children one doesn't have the time to say. I wanted them to know I wasn't always their mother. I was a girl. I had best friends. We did stupid things together. I was on a bus with my friend once, eating dog bones so people would look at us. I wanted them to know." She took the book that she had written down to the ad agency that she owned to use the photocopy machine there, and she put the copies in big red binders with illustrations that she had sketched in plastic sheet protectors, and she handed them out to her children and a few close friends,
and she was done, or thought she was. But the cousin of a friend got hold of one of the binders and sent it over to Algonquin Books, and pretty soon they were calling her about publishing the thing. Beckerman said they offered her an advance that had a comma in it. I think I fainted. The book came out in 1995. It was called Love, Loss, and What I Wore, the story of growing up in Manhattan in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, accompanied by drawings of the clothes that she was wearing during that time. When the book came out, bookstores weren't sure whether to market it as memoir or fashion, but it's now sold over 100,000 copies. Beckerman said that clothes were the least important part of her book, which she considered a memoir. The book containing advice from her grandmother who raised her, such as, if you have to stand on your head to make somebody happy, all you can expect is a big headache. It's the birthday of psychologist Erik Erikson, born in Frankfurt, Germany, 1902, who argued that the human life cycle could be understood as a series of 8 developmental stages, and that each had its own crisis that must be overcome before you can move on to the next stage. For adolescents, the crisis is figuring out who you are and what you want to do with your life. And that's where the term identity crisis comes from. And it's the birthday of the great master of the Japanese haiku, Kobayashi Issa, born in Kashiwabara, Japan in 1763, who by the end of his life had written over 20,000 haiku. Here's a poem for today by Annie Lightheart, entitled The Second Music. Now I understand that there are 2 melodies playing, one below the other, one easier to hear, the other lower, steady, perhaps more faithful for being less heard, yet always present. When all other things seem lively and real, this one fades, yet the notes of it touch as gently as fingertips, as the sound of the names laid over each child at birth. I want to stay in that music without striving or cover. If the truth of our lives is what it is playing, the telling is so soft that this mortal time, this irrevocable change, becomes beautiful. I stop and stop again to hear the second music. I hear the children in the yard, a train, then birds. All this is in it and will be gone. I set my ear to it as I would to a heart. The Second Music, a poem by Annie Lightheart from Iron String, published by Airlie Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with its APRON project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon here on Monday, June 15th, 2015. It's about 20 minutes till the top of the hour and currently 79 degrees at the Juno Airport.
This is Bird Note. In a beautiful, dramatic, and at times deadly aerial ballet, a peregrine falcon dives on a flock of shorebirds, dunlins. Seeking escape, the dunlins flash white and dark, rippling through the sky. Recent years have seen dramatic changes in this dance. Since the banning of the pesticide DDT in 1973, peregrine numbers have increased dramatically on both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. In response, dunlins have adapted. For one thing, they've gotten lighter and faster, according to Dr. Ron Eidenberg and his colleagues at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. To avoid vulnerable roosting, dunlins are spending an average of 3 more hours each day in the air. their response to heightened danger has substantially reduced the reserves of fat. And when feeding, birds in the West are gathering more frequently on wide-open mudflats and avoiding enclosed tidal inlets. As Eidenberg puts it, the Dunlins are defending their survival in a variety of ways that trade off food, rest, and safety. And in reviewing 30 years of research, he's seen no persistent sharp decline in Dunlin numbers. As to whether succeeding generations of Dunlin will continue to adapt to be lighter, faster, and more often in flight, only time will tell.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon here on Monday, June 15th, about 17 minutes till the top of the hour. I have a few extra minutes on the show today, so I picked a selection from May 13th, Mudrooms, Poop, Parasites, and Pests. Here's Aaron Cook telling his mudroom story.
His name is Aaron Cook. Last spring, four boats and about a dozen crew set a course for Taku Harbor, located approximately 20 miles south of Juneau. Their mission? A bachelor party in the great outdoors. Little did the groom-to-be know he had a rendezvous with destiny in an outhouse.
So Juneau is quite a small town, and I know a lot of you are going to probably be able to identify the groom, but just for some semblance of anonymity, I'm going to refer to him in this story as Mr. E. So we went out for this bachelor party, and it was the location we picked was the Tiger Olson Cabin. The Tiger Olson Cabin is a publicly available rentable cabin that you can get through the state of Alaska. And this bachelor party was kind of stereotypical in a lot of ways. We had a lot of cans of beer, we had a lot of bottles of beer, we had a lot of kegs of beer, and we had a lot of bottles of whiskey too. A real big hit that was at the bachelor party was provided by Zach, which was a spud gun. Now, a spud gun is basically a PVC cannon that fires potatoes really fast. And the one Zach built was quite powerful. It packed a wallop. It was throwing like 1 pound potatoes a couple hundred yards. And we were having a lot of fun with this thing, launching it and sending potatoes up out into Taku Harbor and watching them splash. Now, unfortunately, Mr. E got a hold of the spud gun, and his goal was terrorism, and he ended up launching potatoes at Myron and myself, and we were down on the docks about 100 yards away, and he also launched a couple potatoes at Brian in his sailboat when he was rolling in to the dock there, and Brian had a big sail and wasn't very happy about that at all. So we also had one female that was at the bachelor party. She was naked. She was also inflatable. But she ended up getting partially melted in the campfire. Somehow, like early the next morning, she was strung up swinging in the mast of Saunders' yacht on the flagpole there. Also brought there was, surprise, it's a bachelor party, a large plastic African-American male member. It also ended up partially melted in the campfire. But Mr. E also, for some reason, he loved that thing. He was running around and coming up behind people and sticking them in the ear and face and stuff like that. There's a little side story on that, I guess. I heard, now, I didn't find out this firsthand, but apparently that object we were talking about turned up a couple days later at the wedding reception. Fast forward to the next morning. And so the next morning, we woke up and we were extremely hungover. We were pretty sluggish and our heads were down. And we were starting to gather around the smoldering remnants of the campfire there. And we had like a Coleman stove with some bacon and eggs and a pot of coffee. And I just happened to catch some movement out of the corner of my eye. And I turned and looked, and in a T-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops, it was Mr. E sneaking his way to the outhouse. And I knew in that moment exactly what I was going to do. a light bulb went off. So I quickly turned back so he didn't notice that I had spotted him. I let him go into the outhouse, door closed, and then I turned to the rest of the crew that was gathered around, and I said, "Hey guys, Mr. E's just gone into the crapper, and the spud gun is right over there." Once I said that, everyone jumped into action. The hangover's gone. Everyone was pretty much on the same page on this one, and they knew exactly what had to be done. They were on a mission. So Zach bolted into the cabin to go grab his GoPro. The rest of the crew mobilized and somehow transformed into this elite crack army howitzer artillery team. And Pat grabbed the spud gun, and Chris grabbed the potato spud ammo, and I think it was Neil or someone grabbed the spray fuel for it. And they had that thing locked and loaded in probably 10 seconds. Pat grabbed the spud gun and moved into firing position about 15 yards from the outhouse. The rest of us followed to witness the festivities. He took the spud gun, took aim at the front of the outhouse door, and fired. To say that that spud, when it hit that door, became mashed potatoes would be a little bit of an understatement. It was more like a starchy mist that spread out. And there was mist and spray going up into the fir trees and such. The most glorious part about the whole impact was not the visual, it was the sound. And now, I know some of you probably, when you were visualizing this outhouse, might have pictured a wooden outhouse. This was one of those turquoise plastic outhouses like you'd see at the porta potties around town. And there was something magical about that plastic because it really just generated this resonating, loud, amplifying sound when that potato hit it. It kind of sounded like a car crash, and my ears, I was 15 yards away, and my ears were ringing. I kind of felt bad for Mr. E. Not really. So about 10 seconds elapsed after the impact, and there was dead silence. There wasn't screaming, yelling, cussing, crying, whimpering. It was just quiet. Finally, he comes out, and he just was completely expressionless. I think in World War I, they'd call this shell shock. He stood there for a few seconds with his audience watching him, and he spoke, and the only words he could mutter were, "Wow, that was loud." After that, we didn't have any problems with Mr. E. He was pretty well behaved. Just the disclaimer, there was no damage done to the outhouse, state cat property. And as for Zach and the GoPro, unfortunately, he didn't get in there in time to get it fired up and get the shot off. Instead of the video being shared with your Facebook friends, it ended up, you end up getting a mudroom story tonight. Thanks.
It's about 10 minutes until the top of the hour here on a Juneau afternoon. It's climbed to 81 degrees out at the Juneau Airport.
Having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The temperature's rising, it isn't surprising. She certainly can. Started the heat wave by letting her seat wave. And in such a way that the customers say that she certainly can. She jump to 93. Yes, sir, we're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The way that she moves that thermometer proves that she certainly can. Gee, to 93. Yes, sir, we're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The way that she moves that thermometer proves that she certainly can. Certainly can.
The 4th of July is always a fun time in Juneau, but this year will be extra special with the arrival of the new old-time Chautauqua. Made up of 55 talented artists, musicians, and vaudeville performers, including the Flying Karamazov Brothers, the new old-time Chautauqua will infuse the festivities with several opportunities for fun, including a community potluck, a chalk drawing contest, an afternoon of workshops, and of course their vaudeville show on the 3rd. The full event schedule and vaudeville show tickets are at k2.org.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, presenting their new flagship cafe and bakery located on 130 Front Street in downtown Juneau. Featuring fresh baked goods, homemade soups, salads, and more. Information at heritagecoffee.com.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juneau afternoon today. It's about 5 minutes till the top of the hour. Tomorrow I'll be your host again, and we'll talk with Charles McHenry about Wednesday's open house at the Juneau Public Health Center. We'll find out about some upcoming fundraisers for local musician C. Scott Fry. Ray Friedlander will be here to highlight the boardroom. And we'll talk with Michelle Effers from the CBJ Engineering Department about Wednesday's community forum on the Franklin and Front Street Reconstruction Project. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music and More, live at 3 on KTOO, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and online via ktoo.org. It's currently 81 degrees at the Juneau Airport. And for the weather forecast, Tuesday, mostly cloudy, scattered showers in the afternoon, mainly south of Taku Inlet, highs around 72. Light winds becoming southwest to 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy, scattered showers. Wednesday, mostly cloudy, isolated showers, highs around 65. Southwest wind 10 miles per hour. Thursday and Thursday night, mostly cloudy, scattered showers, highs around 65, lows around 50. Friday through Saturday, mostly cloudy, highs around 66, lows around 49. Stay tuned for the news coming up in about 2 minutes.